we are following Alpha, the Alpha program. We're actually in the fourth, we've done 4 weeks of Alpha, believe it or not. And so a few of you are attending. We've got some outsiders from the church. It's an introduction to Christian faith. It's a very powerful program. Last week, on Tuesday evening, we looked at how to have faith. That's what we're going to look at today. When you woke up this morning, did you expect to wake up? Well, if you're like me, you'd say, yes, I did. I expected to wake up. I went to bed last night with the sheer confidence I would wake up this morning. I had no reason not to presume I wouldn't wake up today. At some point this morning, the sun came up. I'm not exactly sure when. I'm not sure if it's fully up yet, but it's come up. Are you surprised that the sun came up this morning? No? Probably not. Sun always rises up in the morning, doesn't it? When you put the kettle on and it started heating the water for your coffee or tea, were you taken back in astonishment? Probably not, because our electricity grid is designed to be reliable 990 times out of 1,000 days. Of course, if you're from South Africa, that's a different problem, right? You might be more surprised. Many of you drove to church this morning. When you put the key into the ignition and turned it and your car started, were you amazed? Probably not, because it turns on most mornings, doesn't it? It almost always turns on when you turn the ignition switch. And when you got to church today and you sat down in one of the pews, were you surprised when it didn't collapse and throw you onto the ground? Probably not. The pew is probably one of the most sturdy pieces of furniture ever created by human beings. It would take a lot of rot to collapse a pew. Now, you had faith that the sun would rise. You had faith when you flipped on the kettle. You had faith that your car would start, and you had faith when you sat in the pew today. Because someday, you're not going to wake up. And perhaps someday in the future, the sun won't rise. And perhaps someday that kettle of yours won't turn on when you flick it on. It won't come on. And someday you're going to go out there and you're going to turn the ignition switch and the car isn't going to start. And someday you may even come into the church and it's going to crack and fall apart and throw you onto the ground. So why didn't you think it would happen today? Because you had faith. You had faith in life. You had faith in the sun. You had faith in electricity and your kettle. You had faith in your car. You had faith in the pew. But in principle, you have no right or basis to presume that what happened yesterday will happen today or happen tomorrow. We just assume it will happen that way. We might have good reasons, perhaps, to believe that it's going to happen in a certain way. You might have good reasons today to have faith that you're going to wake up or that the sun is going to rise. But this reliance on past experience as an indicator of what's going to happen today or tomorrow rests not on fact, but on the character of faith. The whole experience of life cannot function without faith. You cannot live life apart from faith. By faith, I mean trusting in what you cannot immediately see, like the future. You cannot live in any meaningful sense as a human being without some basic trust in the unfolding of the universe in all its myriad of forms. If you did not have faith in people, you couldn't possibly drive a car. Every intersection, every stop sign, every traffic light would become an existential crisis for you. Will that person stop or not? Will they obey the traffic rules and laws or not? You see, because not everybody always obeys the rules of the road and the various traffic laws. We know that. That's why we can know that sometimes there are horrible accidents that happen when people drive vehicles. But if you distrusted every driver all the time, you couldn't function behind the wheel. You'd have a nervous breakdown every time you drove. The question is, why do you trust the multitude of drivers out there who you don't even know? People you know nothing about. And yet you do trust them, and you do manage to get to church in your vehicle in reasonably good psychological condition. How did that happen? Faith. Most of you went to bed last night without soul-crushing anxiety. On what basis do you have such confidence that you're going to wake up today? It's certainly not based on our predictive ability about the future. It's based on faith. My point to you today is that faith is the cornerstone of life. It's the foundation of life. Life exists because of faith. Where there is no faith, ultimately there is no life. In many respects, we talk about faith in God in a distinct way, as if faith is only related to the reality of God. We can even call religions a faith. What is your faith? Well, I'm a Christian, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Jew, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Buddhist. But when we speak this way, we pass over all the ways we engage in the activity of life separate from faith. We think that somehow our everyday life has no faith involved in it, but it does. It's filled with faith. And I don't think believing in God, trusting God, having faith in God, is really any different in scope than believing in, trusting in, having faith in your kettle, or in your car, or in the fact that the sun's going to rise this morning. I think there are lots of people who don't believe in God, who don't share a faith in something beyond themselves, because they think that believing in God is sufficiently different from believing in all sorts of other things that we do believe in, that we do trust, that we do have faith in. But there's a certain irony in all this, because the future is as uncertain as the existence of God. And we don't know what waits around the corner for us. We can't see anything beyond the immediate present. We don't know what's even going to happen when we pull up to that four-way stop sign intersection. Yet we manage to find faith in those types of circumstances in life. How really different is belief or trust in God? A potential response might be, well, we understand the basic laws of the universe today. Einstein created all those special equations for general relativity, and Newton created a bunch of equations explaining gravity and motion, and we understand the basic rules of cause and effect in creation today, how the world operates, so we can reasonably predict the future. But here's the thing. Why would you presume that those laws work the same all through time? On what basis would you presume that the laws of gravity and motion, the basic rules of cause and effect that work in the world, apply today or tomorrow like they did in the past? See, that's an act of faith to believe that. That the rules and the rules of the science of motion and gravity will apply tomorrow like they did today or yesterday. There's an ultimate irony in all this. We who live here today in the technologically sophisticated Western culture, who have braced in a scientific way in the way we understand life, fail to understand that the whole scientific endeavor rests on faith. We believe that the laws of nature that are applied yesterday will apply today and tomorrow. That's faith. Almost all our historical scientific reconstructions, whether it's tectonic plate theory or whether it's the theory of evolution or the theories around the origin of the universe or the dating of the universe, climate reconstructions rest on the axiom or scientific principle called uniformitarianism. That's a mouthful for you. Should be up there. I would like to have a little spelling bee to see if you could form. There it is. Uniformitarianism. Ever heard of that word before? It's the belief, the belief that there is uniformity between the past and the present. Simply put, uniformitarianism suggests that the same forces that operate in nature today are the exact same forces that operated in nature in the past. There is a uniform relationship in creation between past, the past, and the present, and potentially the future, too. And this allows us to extrapolate backwards, come up with reconstructions of the past. But how does anyone know that this is true? How do we know that there's a uniform relationship between the past and the present? There's no way to objectively test for this. You have to presume it. It becomes an axiom of science. There is no scientific way to prove uniformitarianism, that the forces at work in creation today are exactly the same as the forces that were at work in the creation in the past, in the distant past. This basic feature of the scientific enterprise rests on faith. It starts with faith, not blind faith, of course. There are good reasons to believe that uniformitarianism is correct, that there is a uniformity between the past and the present, but this is a belief. It's not a fact. We have to have a certain trust that it is true in order to do certain tasks in science. There are actually a lot of these foundational axioms that work in science that are untestable. People start from an act of faith and work outwards from that place of faith. Now, I'm cool with that. How about you? I'm cool with that because I believe that everything in life in some manner or another rests on faith. There's no way to avoid faith in life. There is no human endeavor in life that sits apart from faith. Do you believe that? If you do, it takes faith to believe that. I think the only question really around faith is how far are we prepared to go with it? How far are you prepared to apply faith in your life? If the everyday realities of life rest on faith, and if science in many, many ways rests on faith, if faith is intertwined with life in a very intimate way, if life requires faith to function, then the question for me today is how far am I willing to push faith out into my life? Or how far along the path of faith am I prepared to walk? And it's at this point that I think we line up with the story that Doug read for us today in Matthew's Gospel. Jesus has taken Peter, James, and John with him up onto a high mountain where he was revealed to them in what is called the Transfiguration of the Lord. This was the time when Jesus was consumed with a brilliant white heavenly light on the mountaintop, and Moses and Elijah came there and conversed with him. And afterwards, Jesus and his three disciples descend from the mountaintop back into the demon-possessed valley, where they were immediately confronted with a crisis. A man had brought his ill son to the disciples, who had been waiting for the four of them in the valley, the other nine, so to speak. The father had obviously asked the disciples to heal his son, but the disciples had not been able to heal him. And this had created a huge commotion with the crowd that had gathered around the whole set of circumstances. And so when Jesus arrives, the father immediately confronts Jesus with the problem. His boy is consumed with a dark spirit that seems to want to destroy him, a spirit that causes him to fall into water, into fire. The boy is obviously a harm to himself, but Jesus' disciples are impotent to change any of this. Modern interpreters see the condition of the boy as a form of epilepsy. This is a perfect example of using the present to interpret the past with the assumption that there is a uniformity between the two. Symptoms like we experienced in the Gospel of Matthew that we would describe as epilepsy must therefore be epilepsy in Jesus' days. That's a faith. That's an assumption. Probably true, but we don't know for sure. It's obvious that the situation Jesus finds is consumed with unbelief, deep skepticism. The disciples have faith. Some interpreters believe that the father has faith, but I don't think he has any faith. He's got desperation and despair. That's why he falls at Jesus' knees. That's why he commends Jesus, why he calls him Lord, literally, Master, because he has no faith. Jesus is his last hope. In frustration, Jesus cries out, "You unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you?" And then Jesus commands that the boy be brought to him. Instantly, Jesus rebukes the dark spirit that has dominated the boy, and it comes out of him, and the boy is healed immediately. And then the disciples sheepishly come up to Jesus afterwards. They're obviously defeated by their circumstances, defeated by their powerlessness before the dark spirit, the demonic presence. And they ask Jesus why they couldn't heal the boy. And Jesus answers them by saying to them that they have so little faith. If you had even the faith of a poppy seed, literally a mustard seed, the smallest seed found in all of the ancient Middle East, the smallest seed imaginable that could actually produce anything, if you had a scrap of faith, Jesus says to him, if you had even one iota of faith, you could say to this mountain, and here I imagine Jesus turning back to the mountain that he, Peter, James, and John had just come down, and pointing at the mountain, he points at the mountain, he says, if you had even a tiny morsel of faith, the tiniest morsel of faith, you could say to this mountain, move from here and go there, and it would happen. If you had just the teeniest, weeniest morsel of faith, literally nothing would be impossible for you. Now, here's the thing. The disciples did have a morsel of faith. They used this morsel of faith all through their day, in all the little ways that faith is required to make life work in the valley. They used their faith moment by moment. There was nothing that they had done that day that didn't require some element of faith in order to bring it about. It's probably true to say that the disciples had a considerable amount of faith in them in order to accomplish their day-to-day activities. The disciples had more than enough faith to cause that mountain to move from there to here. The disciples had come to believe, unfortunately, falsely, that they required some special kind of faith, some special kind of faith dispensation from God in order to participate in God's miracle making. They didn't know how to apply their day-to-day faith, the faith that's necessary to live, to the matters of God. And I think we have the same problem. We think we need some super faith in order to be an effective agent of God in life. We need some kind of super faith juice flowing in us from God in order to be God's conduit of grace and goodness to the world. We have been falsely taught that there are different orders of faith at work in life. But there's only one faith at work in us and through us. The faith that gave you confidence in your kettle this morning is the same faith that can move a mountain. Now, this might seem preposterous to you. How can it be? But it is not. God is only asking from us that we take that little morsel of faith that we use again and again and again in everyday life and apply it to his work in the world. Don't you understand? Jesus is saying to us, it's not you or me that's going to cause the miracle to take place. It's God. It's not you or me that heals anyone. It's God that heals through us. It's not you or me that necessarily blesses anyone in life. It's the blessing that comes through us from God. Our faith is that little bridge that makes the connection, that flicks the switch on, that allows the energy of the Spirit to flow, That's all we are asked to do. If the Lord were here, I think he would want us to harness the faith that is already at work in us. He's just asking us to apply our faith to the work of God in life, to God's work. And it's not hard to do, actually. It's very easy to turn the switch on. It begins first with recognizing where faith is already at work in your life today. I invite you to take a faith inventory today of what you've been about in your life. What have you been doing today that requires faith as a starting point in what you're up to? When you go out to your car and you turn the ignition switch on to go home, think about that. That act of faith that you're doing when you put the key into the ignition switch. When you flick on the switch at home and expect the light to come on, just think for a moment that there's faith involved in you flicking the switch on. All Jesus wants us to do is to take that faith and apply it to God's work in the world. It probably means we won't fully understand what's going on through us, but then that's already the case. There's a lot we don't understand, but it doesn't stop us. That's why faith is so essential in life. There's so much that we don't understand, or so much we don't, or we cannot ultimately prove to ourselves. Following Jesus means applying our one faith a bit wider than we normally would. It means applying our faith a bit wider than we might otherwise choose to. Or perhaps walking the path of faith a bit farther than we might otherwise choose to. But imagine this, imagine that little scrap of faith in us moving mountains.